The headlines. The U.S. President's National Security Advisor says that he will ensure a smooth transition to Democrat Joe Biden if he's deemed the winner of the presidential election. New York Times report says U.S. President Donald Trump was considering attacking an Iranian nuclear facility last week. Also in the headlines, Qatar says the normalization of ties with Israel by some Arab states undermines efforts for Palestinian statehood. Thanks for joining us. U.S. President Donald Trump's National Security Advisor says that Joe Biden is deemed to be the winner of the November 3rd presidential election.
There is a new administration. Like, they deserve some time to come in and implement their policies. We may have policy disagreements, but look, if the Biden-Harris ticket is determined to be the winner, and it's, you know, obviously things look that way now, we'll have a very professional transition from the National Security Council. There's no question about it.
O'Brien stressed that there will be a smooth transition of power if Biden is confirmed president. He said very professional folks would take positions at the White House in the Biden administration. Nearly 2 weeks after the U.S. presidential vote, incumbent Trump has refused to concede. He insists that his Democratic rival Biden has won because the election was rigged. Trump's stance has sparked tensions between the Republican and Democratic camps. It has also triggered demonstrations by supporters of both Trump and Biden. Edward Corrigan is an international lawyer who joins us. Edward Corrigan, do you believe what the National Security Advisor of Trump has said means that at least his team has accepted the fact that Trump has lost?
Yes, I believe that most of his team has accepted that he's lost the election. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has spoken to him about making an announcement conceding. A number of other prominent Republicans, people in the administration, have also said the same thing. The National Security Advisor, by telegraphing the fact there will be a smooth transition if, in fact, Biden is declared the winner officially, that there will be a smooth transition. And that's sending a message from the national security apparatus, the Pentagon, etc., that they will support the transition of power from the Trump administration to the Biden administration. So yes, it's a clear signal. Many generals and admirals and stuff also came out publicly in favor of Joe Biden. Former members of the head of the CIA, former national security advisors. In fact, former Republican presidents came out against Donald Trump in favor of Joe Biden. So what we're seeing here is maybe just a bit of a delusion on the part of Trump that he could still somehow win the election. But even if he wins and overturns Arizona and Georgia, he's still short. Biden has, actually by my calculation, if you include Georgia, he's got 306 electoral college votes compared to Trump's 232. Sorry. And so there's no way that even if they flip Arizona or flip Georgia or flip both of them, that they have enough electoral college votes to overturn the election. Trump has been sort of making a campaign and trying to prevent and even sabotage the postal system because he knows the higher the turnout is, and particularly with mail-in ballots, that they go overwhelmingly for the Democrats. So Trump did everything in his power to fight them, except he was arguing when he was ahead, they had to immediately stop counting the ballots. But when he was behind, he also wanted to continue to counting the ballots, so he thought he might catch up. He's just playing, a game. But there is a logic to what Trump is doing. Trump is trying to invigorate the base. He's trying to still fundraise money to pay off the debt, quite frankly, for the election, and also to raise money for the fight in Georgia, because there's still two Senate positions that have to be determined. If the Democrats win both of them, then actually they would have control of the Senate. It would be like a 50-50 split with the vice president having the deciding vote. Like, that's as close as it could possibly come. But really what they're doing is trying to raise money. And if you look at the fine print, it says that small donations are not necessarily going to go to pay the debt. They're setting up a war fund to fund these lawsuits, but they lost 23 out of 24, so they're getting almost nowhere on the lawsuits. In fact, a lot of the big law firms are withdrawn because they got nothing to say. You're complaining there weren't observers, but then you admit there were observers and stuff. So everything has gone against him. I heard that he did win one lawsuit, but I don't know what the facts are, and I don't think it would make a difference if he wins the one lawsuit. He's not going to get anything up to the Supreme Court, which I think was his ultimate wish. But they're trying to raise money for a super PAC that Trump wants to control, and also for the National Republican Committee, and then for this Georgia election. And doing it. So he's trying to raise money that he will control, and the fear is that he'll actually siphon it, and has maybe already siphoned a lot of money into his businesses, because he's got hundreds of millions of dollars of debt that are coming due very soon. So this will keep Trump in the game, invigorating his base, and of course raising tens of millions of dollars that he could use in a PAC for his own personal purposes, or and to manipulate and to increase his power within the Republican Party, even though he is a defeated candidate. And usually the defeated candidates disappear.
Right.
It's rare. Nixon came back after one defeat, but that's, I think, the only example I can think of. There have been people run a couple times. However, so it's a big scam, really, that Trump is trying to still raise money and still milk his base, saying, "Oh, we didn't win, we didn't lose the election, we won, we're still going to fight on in Georgia." But he's really trying to pay down his debt and increase his own power and to have a lot of money at his disposal that he can continue to manipulate the policy. And also, it's a big blow to his ego that he lost. He just says, "I can't believe that this is true." But he is has a personality disorder. He's extremely narcissistic and doesn't want to lose, and has a terrible record of losing, even though he's lost many, many times over his life in businesses and things. He's got tons of bankruptcies, divorces, et cetera, et cetera. But, this is really, I think, a scam that they're trying to milk Trump's base for as much money as they can before he officially leaves the scene. And the chances of him overturning the election, I think, are 0.1%.
Thank you very much for that. Edward Corrigan, international lawyer there. U.S. President Donald Trump has reportedly asked his top aides about the possibility of striking Iran's nuclear facilities. According to the New York Times, Trump floated the idea last Thursday during a meeting with his close aides. They included the vice president, the secretary of state, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, among others. The officials dissuaded Trump by warning him that an attack on Iran could escalate into a broader regional conflict in the last weeks of his presidency. The U.S. president has unleashed a campaign of threats and sanctions against Tehran since he pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal back in 2018. Iran in September warned that a U.S. military action would be a strategic mistake and pledged to give a decisive response. Colin Campbell in Washington, D.C. gives us more details about the backdrop to Trump's meeting on a strike on Iran.
Many people believe that the president was thinking of doing this as a distraction from what is happening now, and that is a failure to concede the loss of the presidential election and to engage in a transition with President-elect Joe Biden. And one thing is for certain, if the president were to carry out any type of military strike, it would make things much more difficult for the president-elect to continue the transition. And it would definitely make the headlines distracting from the chaos that the president is creating by reluctantly wanting to concede the race. This is definitely something that senior advisors and officials dissuaded the president from doing. And in fact, when the president suggested a military strike, they talked to him and spoke to him and told him how much the wider repercussions would lead to further disaster and problems for the United States, meaning that this would be a bigger problem for the United States than it may be for Iran, or maybe it would be equally problematic for both countries. They left the conversation thinking that this idea was tabled and that the president would not carry through with it. But we do know that the president can be somewhat mercurial when it comes to his decision making. But because of the advice from senior officials and senior advisors, and the fact that there is a president-elect coming in January to become president, it's largely believed that this would not be something that would come to fruition, and that is a military strike on Iran.
Iran's envoy to the U.N. says the Security Council is dominated and taken advantage of by Western nations. In a speech to the U.N. General Assembly on reforming the Council, Majid Taqdir Avanchi said the body's composition is currently undemocratic, as it lacks a strong presence by developing nations. He added that any reform of the Council must encompass the interests of all U.N. members. Taqdir Avanchi went on to say that the 15-member Council is facing a crisis of legitimacy and credibility due to its poor, passive, and in some cases, illegal and extra-legal decisions. Political commentator Lawrence Davidson says that any reform of the U.N. Security Council would be a difficult process since the U.S. and Russia are unwilling to relinquish their veto rights.
The Security Council was designed to control the organization, the U.N. When it was set up after the Second World War, the only way that the Russians and the Americans would join the UN was if they had permanent position on the Security Council and a veto power. So essentially the same objections that have been brought to the fore now and have been repeatedly in the past are the reasons that you've got a participation by the Americans and at the time the Soviet Union, but now the Russians. And they threw in the French and the British because they were allies of the Americans. So what I'm trying to say is that it's difficult historically, it's difficult to see the Americans and the Russians staying in the UN without control, without some sort of veto control.
Qatar says the normalization of ties with Israel by some Arab states undermines efforts for Palestinian statehood.
I think it's better to have a united front and to have to put the interest of the Palestinian people to end the occupation and to recognize the two-state solution and to go back to the borders of 1967 with an independent sovereign state of Palestine, with the capital East Jerusalem, as all the international resolution stating. And this is the solution and the vision that Qatar is looking for. We want to see negotiations happening between the Israelis and the Palestinians to put an end for this conflict, because the Palestinian people, they are the ones who are paying for this conflict.
From our perspective, we see that...
The Qatari foreign minister added that the Arab world can gain leverage over Israel by presenting a united front and that divisions will not be in the interest of the Palestinians. His reaction came in response to the U.S. brokered deals under which the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan agreed to establish ties with Israel. The move was met with fierce condemnation from across the Muslim world. Sudan's Information Minister Faisal Mohammed Saleh has revealed that U.S. President Donald Trump wanted to use Sudan as an election card by pressuring it to normalize ties with the Israeli regime. Paul Arudi with the Free Palestine Movement says the normalization of ties between some Arab states and Israel is aimed at undercutting the future of a Palestinian state.
The United States and Israel intended to undermine the future Palestinian state and to undermine the ongoing suppression of the Palestinians so that eventually they would be of no importance. So this is the objective of Israel. Qatar has always had a certain amount of independence. For example, its decision to have a different policy, foreign policy, than its very big neighbor, Saudi Arabia. And it has, as a result, at least explored more friendly relations with Iran. So Qatar is basically saying, first of all, we're not joining you, and we are an independent nation, and we'll decide ourselves what we're going to do, and we prefer to stay loyal to our brothers in Palestine.
Thousands of Armenians have once again hit the streets of the capital Yerevan to demand the resignation of Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan. Protesters marched through the streets chanting Nikol is a traitor. Yerevan has witnessed several such protests since Pashinyan signed a ceasefire deal with Azerbaijan to end the fighting over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. The ceasefire announced on November the 10th secured territorial advances for Azerbaijan into the region. Pashinyan himself called the deal a disaster, but said that he had no choice but to sign it to stave off a defeat. The Russia-brokered truce halted military action in and around the region. Some 2,000 Russian peacekeeping troops are now deployed to the region to monitor the ceasefire. A new scandal has hit the British Labour Party, this time involving rampant Islamophobia within its ranks. A new report has made several shocking discoveries, which appear to show the hatred of Muslims is at an all-time high, but the response to the findings has been lukewarm. Rob Carter brings us the details.
Members of the Labour Party staff.
The British Labour Party has found itself entangled in yet another racism crisis after a new report found huge levels of Islamophobia within the party. The report, commissioned by the newly formed Labour Muslim Network, suggests that current party leader Sir Keir Starmer has greatly lost the trust of his party's Muslim members. Just some of the damning results claim that
more than one in four Muslim members and supporters have experienced Islamophobia within party ranks. 59% say they do not feel well represented by the leadership. 55% claim they don't even trust the leadership to tackle Islamophobia effectively, while 46% feel the party doesn't represent the community effectively.
In response to the report, I reached out to British Muslims who have already decided to quit the party to ask why they felt they had to leave.
And from the people I've met, the counsellors I've experienced, the talking I've had, conversations, prior to even Keir Starmer's appointment, there was a problem within the Labour Party. Once he came into his position, it just reinforced everything that we were already saying that is happening and existing. And this was the reason for my exodus and the large exodus by my community.
The report, which interviewed hundreds of British Muslim members, added that some key policy issues create hurt amongst Muslims, including its stance on Israeli crimes in Palestine and Starmer's U-turn on Labour's Kashmir policy earlier this year.
Leave the Labour Party, cut off your cards, and let your friends and family know that this is what's happening, and Keir Starmer shouldn't be able to silently still get our vote and then still implement these ways. Labour is a failed system. Labour is a crumbling system, and Labour is not something that will represent us as British Muslims who live in the UK now. You know, it's just not. And Keir Starmer, I would sincerely hope that you would consider your position on the Kashmir issue.
Before Starmer took over, the party was rocked by the anti-Semitism crisis for many years. Some even argue it's what brought down the previous leadership. But the question is, will the response be the same to this blatant crisis of Islamophobia within the party? Many are arguing not. Robert Carter, London.
India has posted over 29,000 new coronavirus infections in the past 24 hours. That is the lowest number of daily COVID cases since mid-July. According to the Health Ministry, the figure brings India's total confirmed cases to over 8.8 million. Daily infections have fallen there since hitting a peak in September, but experts have warned that a festival held at the weekend could lead to a new spike. In South Korea, a recent surge in daily cases has prompted authorities to impose stricter social distancing rules for the greater Seoul area. The restrictions will start on Tuesday night. They came as daily infections surpassed 200 for a fourth straight day. Officials have warned of a bigger crisis if the current curves fail. And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, if you remember, it was said that Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, considered acquisition of knowledge as a great divine obligation. The Imam strived to learn knowledge and also encouraged others to acquire it. Imam Khomeini's method of education, both in learning and teaching, was very outstanding amongst ulama and religious scholars and students of seminaries. Imam Khomeini used to criticize the sayings and ideas of others, whilst he himself would accept the criticism of others. Stay tuned for more. Ancient philosophers like Plato and Aristotle believed that those who acquire knowledge should have the spirit of accepting criticism. Criticism does not mean finding fault with others. It means to be able to think independently, and it turns the individual from a passive recipient into an active learner. Some of the adherents of this thought maintain that critical thought is a conscious phase of processing information in a way that the individual is able to understand subjects better and make better decisions with higher self-reliance. Raising fundamental questions on a particular issue, asking about the existing results and hypotheses, abandoning bias and fanaticism, studying new sources, and consorting with creative people are among the methods of attaining the skill of criticism. The individual should be able to get rid of the chains of confirmation of others. Human beings usually like to be approved by others. That's why they think that if they show innovation, they will lose the approval of others. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, was one of the rare ulama or religious scholars who used to encourage students of seminaries to criticize the ideas of others, even his own ideas. He would even encourage them to criticize the ideas of great scholars and ulama of the past and present which had been accepted and approved as dogma. Hujjat al-Islam Muhammad Reza Nasiri says in this regard, Imam Khomeini used to examine the statements of Ayatollah Sheikh Muhammad Hussein Qaravi a lot because his statements were mixed with philosophy and jurisprudential issues. Then the Imam would explicate those issues completely and raise his own theory. He used to say, the greatness of great people shouldn't prevent us from understanding. No matter how great the words are, you should employ your understanding. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to challenge the ideas of great religious scholars or ulama, although he would respect them very much. Late Ayatollah Abul Qasim Ghazali says, Imam Khomeini, in his class, used to grapple with the great scholars who had caused knowledge to reach climax, and he would succeed. His pupils and friends and our colleagues too would benefit from and be strengthened with his courses. Along his scientific struggle with great scholars, he would say to his pupils, "When you're hearing my words, do not accept them submissively. Think about them and argue. Keep your thought free for argument and do not say that the teacher has said so-and-so or such-and-such. Okay, the teacher has said, but you should employ your own thoughts." Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, would tell the students, who were silent with no disputes, "Here is not the place of preaching and eulogy to keep silent." Late Hujjatul Islam Mustafa Zamani says, "As a custom, when a preacher ascends the pulpit, people keep silent and listen attentively. But the course of ijtihad is not like that. The student should be free to question the teacher." Several times the students of Imam Khomeini didn't ask anything from him in the middle of the class. The Imam would tell them, "This is not the session of eulogy. Why don't you protest or object me or ask questions?" This characteristic of Imam Khomeini had made his classes very effective, very popular, and very fruitful. Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Mahdi Yasribi narrates an anecdote relating to one of the classes of Imam Khomeini when there were heated disputes. He says, "I remember well that people like Mata Mutahari, Mata Beheshti and others would participate in his classes in the first years. When we passed by, there were heated disputes with loud voices and the students had the same spirit of objection, and the Imam would answer as a great teacher." One of the things that Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, innovated was to break the taboo of criticizing great figures. Late Ayatollah Abbas Ali Amid Zamani said, "One of the things that the Imam raised in Najaf as a novel issue was criticism in jurisprudence. Personalities were usually esteemed, highly esteemed in Najaf. I mean, the personality was first, and then it would be the turn for arguments. Many students would be amazed that the Imam listened to them carefully and attentively and answered their questions. This was whilst in some of the courses that we attended, nobody had the right to ask a question with a pretext that the time of class is for all. Thus, free thinking was choked." Dear listeners, although Imam Khomeini would welcome critical thinking, he never allowed the time of the class to be wasted on useless and lengthy arguments. Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Bangerudi says, in this regard, "Imam Khomeini believed that a student should argue within the class, yet if a question and answer was repeated several times, he would prevent it, saying that it is not a dialogue."
The debate.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kavitat Lee. Sudan's information minister has said that the U.S. President Donald Trump wanted to use Sudan as an election card by pressuring it to normalize ties with the Israeli regime. This spells just one side of the story behind Sudan's normalization deal with Israel. What about other Arab countries? Were they also pressured by the U.S. into normalizing ties with Israel? What did they have to give up, and what did they get in return? And what about the rights of Palestinians? Whatever happened to that? Just some of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of the debate. First, let's bring in Ahmed Caballo. He was the person who actually interviewed the information minister to bring us that exclusive coverage and the revelation of the facts. So, Ahmed, tell us about the interview and, of course, what you discovered.
Yeah, to be honest, he gave a very frank interview, much more frank than I was anticipating. And he essentially admitted that Sudan was blackmailed into this decision. He said, from when the transitional government took power, they began negotiating with the US to delist Sudan as a state sponsor of terror. And from day one, they made it clear to the US it had nothing to do with Israel and nothing to do with normalizing ties with Israel. And the US allegedly agreed to those conditions. And it was just merely a couple of weeks before the election, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, changed his mind and said that no, it had to be the principal condition. And if they wanted the state sponsor of terror designation lifted, they had to normalize relations with Israel, which left the transitional government in a very tricky position because the economy was flatlining. The economic minister said that the economy wouldn't last 7 months. So they had to assess their options, and they thought, shall we gamble on the Joe Biden administration? And then they thought, if they gamble on the Joe Biden administration, the problem is that it'll take another 7 months coming with a fact-finding mission, and they might reach the same conclusion. So they were forced to accept a decision that they did not want to due to the economic pressure in Sudan, due to the long queues for fuel, for bread, and the economic crisis that's currently riddling the country.
So basically, from what you're saying is the fact that you had Mike Pompeo that came and gave a different type of approach to the whole scenario, of which I'm assuming that is where you have used the word blackmail, which is indeed what actually transpired based on the way that Pompeo made his request from Sudan. Is that a correct way of looking at it?
Yes, and I asked the minister if he felt that the United States were using the economic situation in Sudan to leverage Sudan to normalize relations with Israel. Now, he gave a diplomatic answer, but if you read between the lines, he essentially admitted that, yes, they knew we were struggling, they knew we had no other options, and they knew that we were going to accept this deal because there was nowhere else for our economy to go.
Okay, very well. Let me now bring in our guests to discuss this a little bit further. Journalist and activist Khaled Barakat joins us from Vancouver. Khaled Barakat, welcome. Our reporter there, Ahmed Caballo, who traveled to Sudan and gave us that interview, of which we came up with this revelation now, which is the topic of our debate, amongst other issues that we're going to discuss. First, let me get a reaction from you of how you think that the U.S. actually used or pressured Sudan into this, of which, as our reporter said, Michael Pompeo, to actually to move forward in a blackmail-type scenario in order to get the normalization deal out of Sudan with Israel.
That is an excellent question, and I think that the U.S. always put pressure on states in order to normalize relationship with Israel. It's not just Sudan. In this case, we know more information because of this interview and also other reports that have indicated clearly that Sudan was pressured into this relationship with Israel. But even some of the Arab reactionary regimes, but they are pressured in a different way. Still, that, you know, the trying to spread the fear in the Arab world that Israel will protect you from Iran, which is a false statement, and also trying to prove or, you know, tell all states in the area that the only way to you to get to the White House and a normal relationship with the U.S., you have to go through Tel Aviv. Basically, if you want to normalize your relationship with the U.S., you have to go through Israel as their allies in the region. Pressure always have been used, sometimes economic pressure, sometimes political pressure. And one of these ways, is especially with illegitimate regimes and governments, that, you know, this card, the U.S. could use it anytime. We know that today, for example, Israel have military bases in Africa, in some of the islands along the Red Sea, and this also exerts military pressure. Some of its nuclear submarines are roaming in the Mediterranean and in the Red Sea. So all of these factors are, you know, just normal, understanding and general wisdom of the people of the area. If it's up to people and even states, if it's up to them, you know, they will not normalize with Israel.
Anna Caballo, you know, when we take a look at the situation in Sudan, prior to that, of course, you had its former president that was there. But, you know, there was a point way back when Sudan had pretty much adamantly stated that it will not have any relationship with Israel, that it would not normalize ties with Israel. And this obviously requires a history check. At what point did the U.S., and I'm guessing along with Israel, feel like there was now an opportunity in order to move forward and make this request or demand, or should I say blackmail, Sudan into this? I mean, could you give us a little bit of a rundown there if you can?
That's a great question. In my analysis, it was when the Saudi-UAE faction of the military dictatorship took over. So within the military apparatus, there's a split between the Muslim Brotherhood-aligned factions and the Saudi-UAE-aligned factions. And what happened when Omar al-Bashir was overthrown in April was that Hemeti and Burhan, who were aligned to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, they took control of the military and became the most powerful men in the country. And when that happened, it became clear that normalizing with Israel was again on the cards, because Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, of course, more keen with relations with Israel than, say, the Brotherhood bloc. And that is when they saw this opportunity. So it was also the fact that Sudan has been considered a pariah state for a long time. And the only way to get access to Washington, as my colleague just mentioned, was to prove to Washington that it now was a reliable client state. And by normalizing relations with Israel, it proves to Washington that Sudan can once again be trusted as a source of influence in the region. Because before that, if we remember in the 90s, Omar al-Bashir had very close relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And now it's quite clear that it's distanced itself from the Islamic Republic of Iran and is very much in the Saudi-Emirati axis.
Okay. Well, Khalid Barakat, we know that this deal has come weeks after the similar moves that were made by the United Arab Emirates and also the Persian Gulf island of Bahrain. The two have become now the first to recognize Israel in 26 years. Tell us whether you think what type of pressure was exerted on them to come out and make the announcement and to formalize this, even though, of course, it's been said that they have had a relationship with Israel behind the scenes.
Well, in principle, there is a camp that is led by the United States and Israel and the Arab reactionary regimes, especially regimes like Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and others. And we need to remember that this camp have an alliance that goes back way back, even to 2012, in a real way. But there is always a secret doors and relationships between these regimes and Israel. Every couple of months, we see a new report that date back these relationships to even after 1967 war. We have to remember that after the 1967 occupation and aggression that Israel launched, Sudan, for example, was the capital that declared no reconciliation, no recognition, and no relationship with Israel. And so for them, Sudan is kind of more of a sentimental, more of a relationship than United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. And later on, you know, down the line, the Saudis are going to come along also and normalize relationship. But Saudi Arabia, you know, that's the big chunk in the peace that Israel is looking at. And the most important thing to remember is that this kind of policies, it is used on the basis of the carrot and the stick. So either, you know, these regimes are getting the carrots or they are get the stick. And basically because they don't have any sense of legitimacy in the country. So, for example, they cannot do that with Tunisia, for example, because we have an elected president in Tunisia. We have a public opinion, very strong political movement, anti-normalization in Tunisia. So they will not be able to pressure Tunisia because it is, it has democratic institutions. But these Arab regimes, they lack these legitimacy. They depend very much on the protection of the United States and now Israel.
Very well. Let me bring in Michael Lane now. He's a political analyst who joins us from Washington, D.C., to bring him into the conversation. Michael Lane, welcome. So let me first get a reaction from you. You know, we have gotten information firsthand that Sudan's information minister has said that the U.S. President Donald Trump wanted to use Sudan as an election card by pressuring it to normalize ties with Israel. Your reaction to that?
Well, it's not surprising. I mean, when you look at the timing of these successes, it was something that the Trump administration had been working toward for a number of years. It was part of their strategy to follow down this route. But when you had three countries, all of whom decided that they were going to play this card and normalize relationships with Israel in the just several months and in some cases only weeks leading up to the election, it was something that the Trump administration worked very, very hard on the timing and getting them to fall before the election rather than after the election. I wouldn't be surprised to hear widespread reports at some time that the Trump administration was pressuring any number of countries to take this step before the election.
When you talk about the U.S. placing pressure, i.e. Donald Trump placing that pressure perhaps, then you know, there could be an observation on that, that there's an or else, meaning a precondition. For example, do you think that there was a precondition set here, as our reporter indicated, through the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, who said that if you want to be taken off the terror list, you have to make this formal, the normalization with Israel? Do you think that that was the case?
You know, there are a number of techniques and tools that the United States would use, the Trump administration or any administration for that matter, the State Department, that they would use in dealing with our both our allies, our friends, and our adversaries in terms of influencing them to do things that we would like to see influenced. So, you know, would it be an exact quid pro quo, if you do A, then we will do or allow B? It wouldn't surprise me if that was used in many circumstances. I can't confirm that it was used in these circumstances. We simply don't know. On the other hand, it might be more general talk about, okay, well, you know, we provide so much in foreign aid to y'all, and, you know, if you would like to see that foreign aid continue at that level or even increase, then we would like to see some cooperation on some things that are important to us. On the other hand, if you can't see your way clear to cooperating on this one particular issue that's important to us, we can't guarantee that Congress will continue to do the foreign aid funding at the same level that it has. Some of the threats can be more direct and more overt than others. Sometimes they can be extraordinarily subtle, but the message still gets across that we are friends, we share a similar point of view. This is one of the things on which we really want you to share our point of view, and there will be rewards, there are carrots and or sticks as we go through, depending on how much of our point of view you share.
Okay, let's talk about the stick. That's important. Khalid Barakat. I mean, when we take a look at the way that the U.S. may have pressured countries like Sudan, like the Persian Gulf island of Bahrain, or with the UAE, how far do you think the U.S. actually pressured them into coming out, making sure that this is something that needs to be out in the open, this so-called normalization with Israel. I mean, do you think that the U.S. exerted a lot of pressure on them in order for this to, again, be out in the open? And also at the same time, I know it's two questions in one, we have to talk about the Palestinian concern here, the topic of Palestine. It doesn't seem to be the number one priority when it comes to the so-called normalization of ties when it comes to these countries.
Well, we have to remember that the mere existence of these regimes depends on the protection of the United States and now the United States and Israel. We also need to remember that these regimes are not really reflecting the will and the sentiment and the position of the people in the country. We know, for example, the regime of Bahrain. This is a regime that absolutely lacks all forms of legitimacy in Bahrain. The people of Bahrain, the vast majority of the people of Bahrain, has been engaged in peaceful demonstrations and uprising, and they have been brutalized by this regime. And so the ruling class of Bahrain wants to protect its interest and its wealth by associating itself with the United States and Israel now, because it's closer. Also, it allures them the fact that the Palestinians are not in their best shape, and that Palestinians are weak, and they look at the Palestinian angle and they see that there will be no reaction, real reaction by Palestinian leadership and Palestinian factions, and therefore nothing will deter these regimes from going into more and more public relationship with Israel. And this is not really normalizing relationship with Israel. This is really building an alliance between, you know, the Zionist colonization state of Israel and these reactionary Arab regimes. One of the things that we need to remember, that the Palestinian factor here is a determining factor. If Palestinians get their internal affairs in place and they take a real and loud position, that will, in my view, deter these Arab reactionary regimes. Nothing else will do. They're not, democratic governments. They're not governments that represent the will of the people, and therefore, why would they listen to Palestinians if they're not listening to the people of Bahrain? 95% of the people of Bahrain said no to normalization. This is the vast majority of the people of Bahrain. And that goes the same in Saudi Arabia and Emirates. If you will conduct a real poll amongst the people of the region, they are against this relationship with Israel.
Okay, so Michael Lane, the Palestinian issue, can you please tell us how the U.S. is approaching that in terms of the rank and the importance that it has when it comes out to these countries that are saying that it has to come out and normalize ties with Israel? I mean, is it trying to tell Palestinians, we're just going to have countries come on board, whether you like it or not, they're announcing their normalization with Israel, and therefore you have to, for example, succumb to the terms of this so-called deal of the century, which at this point is it's at a critical juncture because you have possibly an outgoing President Trump along with his son-in-law Jared Kushner. But do you think that that's the approach that the U.S. is using in order to convince the Palestinians that you don't have a choice now because these countries are coming on board?
I think so, yes, if I understand the question. Look, Trump, when he announced the deal of the century and then sort of moved forward with it, had the U.S. embassy move to Jerusalem, et cetera, was still trying to get Palestinian President Abbas on the phone. And Abbas had to talk to him for months, perhaps as much as 2 years. I forget the exact timing on this. And when that whole thing was started, and Abbas was still refusing to discuss anything with President Trump or with his representatives, the president finally said, okay, well, we're moving ahead with this. This is what we're doing. And I'm going to leave a window open here. The window is 4 years for the Palestinians to decide that they want to come back, talk with us about what they think this agreement should look like. And there was still the door open for some modifications in it, although once it was announced and once it has passed a year, those modifications become extremely difficult to make.
I'm sorry, I got to interrupt you. I've got to jump in here, Michael, and I do apologize. I'm going to bring in Khaled Barakat with the final question in less than a minute, if you can, Khaled Barakat. Our guest there neglects to say that Israel in the past 4 years has continued with its violations of the Palestinian territories, even though the normalization of ties with the UAE, it said that it was going to freeze at least the settlement expansion, but it didn't. Do you think that right now with an outgoing U.S. president that this so-called deal of the century is going to fall flat and not go anywhere? Less than a minute.
Well, I mean, Biden is committed to keep the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. There is not going to be a lot of changes between Biden and Trump in essence, in real essence. There will be a different language used, absolutely. I know that the Palestinian Authority for sure are, clapping for Biden, and they're happy about Biden that Trump is gone now. But I don't think that any real substantial changes that Biden will bring to Palestinians.
Okay.
The only way for Palestinians to move forward is to have an alternative Palestinian revolutionary path.
Very well. We're going to have to end it there. Thank you very much. Let me thank our reporter at the top of the hour at the debate, Ahmed Kabayo, who spoke to us, who brought us that exclusive interview. Thank you so much, Ahmed. Also, political analyst Michael Lane spoke to us from Washington, D.C., and journalist and activist Khaled Barakat, who spoke to us from Vancouver. That is for this edition of The Debate. For me, Kavit Awe, the entire team is goodbye. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
صلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد عجل فرجهم السلام عليكم to you brothers and sisters. Inshallah, tonight we are going to have a glance at one of the very important Islamic topics, of course Quranic topics, and it is the difference between Islam and Iman. Because this is one of the very complicated issues. When you look at ahadith and you recite Quran, you come across to some different ahadith or verses that you see that are somehow given priority sometimes to Iman more than Islam, sometimes the vice versa. Now we want to see what is the right idea and how can we justify these different verses and ahadith according to the right manner that we can find out from Quran itself and also from Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. So inshallah, I start from the literal meaning for Islam, and inshallah we are going to study the different degrees that we have for Islam and Iman. According to books of war literature and Arabic dictionaries, Islam, Taslim, and Istislam, all these words, they have the same meaning, and it is for a person or a thing to be submissive to another person or thing in a way that it never goes beyond the orders of the latter. Means whenever someone orders him to do something, the person does it exactly the way he has been asked, and he never goes against what he was ordered. So there is a kind of submission and there is a kind of surrender in the word Islam in itself. When we look at the Quranic verses, we see that the first degree of Islam which is mentioned, and usually when you ask Muslim brothers and sisters what is the difference between Islam and Iman, they give you this differentiation. They distinguish Islam and Iman in this way. They say Islam is just to utter the formula of faith, formula of Islam. You know, we have two formulas to say, Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah wa ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah. So usually they say Islam is to utter these two, is to confess these two formulas of Islam. And Iman, no matter whether you have this belief in heart or not, but Iman is to have this idea in heart. Yeah, this is right. So it can be in fact the first level of Islam and the first level of Iman. So what is the first level of Islam? We can say the first level of Islam is to confess, is to utter the formulas of faith by your tongue, no matter you have it in the heart or not. In Surah Al-Hujurat, verse 14, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, قَالَتِ الْأَعْرَابُ آمَنَّا. The Bedouins, they came to the Prophet and they said, we have faith. We have faith in Allah. قُلْ لَمْ تُؤْمِنُوا. Tell them, you don't have faith. وَلَكَنْ قُولُوا أَسْلَمْنَا. Rather, you have to say that we are submissive, we have accepted Islam. We have Islam. You have Islam. What you have is not Iman, is not faith. It is